This is fresh air. It's the economy, stupid. That was one of the mottos of the Clinton campaign, a constant reminder to focus and refocus on the economy. Harvard political economist Robert Reich was a senior advisor to the Clinton campaign. He's the author of the book The Work of Nations, Preparing Ourselves for the 21st Century, which sets out some of the principles that inform Clinton's economic thinking. Reich has been friends with Clinton since 1968, when they both went to Oxford as Rhodes Scholars. Clinton has said he will be his own economic czar, but during the campaign, Clinton got advice from several economic advisors who offered different prescriptions for reviving the economy.
The economic advisors to this campaign, and in general the staff overall, there was a great deal of compatibility, far less elbowing, far less turf fighting, much more of a sense of team spirit than I remember in any other campaign that I've been involved in. And I think that comes from the top, because Bill Clinton is someone who tries to achieve a degree of consensus, wants people to develop their own ideas, but defend them in a very rational and reasonable way. So while there was not total unanimity of opinion about everything, the advisors were united about some very basic fundamentals. Number one, you've got to bring the deficit down over 4 years. Number two, you've also got to increase public and private investment. And public investment includes the essentials: education, training, research and development, and roads and bridges and all those unglamorous things that hold us together as a society. The other thing that I think almost all advisors felt united about was the notion that we have to move from a military-based economy to a highly competitive commercial economy. And this is a great challenge over the next 4 or 8 or even 12 years, because we have so much of our entire industrial base tied up to the military.
Now, because the economy was such an important issue during the campaign, and because so many people are hurting, there's going to be a lot of pressure for quick change. Do you think quick change is possible? And do you think there might even be problems with quick change in jeopardizing the long-term future? And third of all, do you think we're going to get really impatient if change doesn't happen soon?
Well, you know, that's precisely my point. These problems have been festering for so long. There's no magic bullet. Most of them require a great deal of patience. Most of them have a very, very long amount of time attached to coming up with a solution. Hopefully, and I say hopefully, a new administration will be able to lay a foundation, do some things that show the public that at least progress is being made, give the public more confidence, and again, public confidence is a big part of the problem. The public now is so resigned to many of these problems just simply getting worse. So much of the public has watched them get worse for so many years that you have a great deal of disengagement on the part of the public, a kind of resignation that is the enemy of real change. If you want to know what the enemy of change is in this country, it's resignation that you can't really have change. You've got to have the public behind it. A lot of this requires a great deal of work at the state and local levels. Ideally, Bill Clinton sets a direction, scores some small-scale victories initially that lay the foundation for a lot of work later on, and give people a feeling that things really are getting better, could get better, that everybody has a role to play.
Now, you and Bill Clinton have a relationship that goes back to the 60s. You met in 1968 when you were both at Oxford University. You were also together at Yale. Can I ask how you became close friends and what kinds of things you had in common?
Well, we really met on the pier in New York City as we were about to take a boat along with about 25 other Rhodes Scholars to Oxford. We were 22 years old and full of beans and eager and excited. We had not been out of the country, most of us ever, including Bill Clinton and me. And we went out on this boat. It was the SS United States. About a day out to sea, Terry, I discovered that I had made a dreadful mistake. I did not have my sea legs. In fact, I turned green, retired down to my little cabin, and thought I would die. There was a knock at my door soon after that, and there stood this big, gangling southerner who I had met very briefly on the pier, soup in one hand, chicken soup, and crackers in the other hand. And he said in a drawl that I wish I could imitate, but I can't, I understand you're not too feeling too well. And much better than my grandmother could ever have done, he nursed me back to health. And that was the beginning of a conversation that we've been having during that nursing period for 24 years. about everything from the economy and society and American society and culture to foreign policy to our families and even what we want to do with our lives.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, you opposed the war in Vietnam and I think had a draft deferment. And I'm sure you spoke a lot with Bill Clinton at the time. He was deciding what to do about the draft. I wonder what you think of how that issue was handled by Clinton and by Bush during the campaign.
Not very well by either of them. I was there at the time. I know exactly what happened. Bill Clinton, when he came back to Oxford in the fall of 1969 for his second year, he had relinquished his ROTC deferment very clearly. He was nervous. He knew he was going to be, or thought that he was going to be drafted at any moment. In fact, he didn't even secure what we call digs, housing for that second year. He slept on our floors, the other Rhodes Scholars who were there, expecting that at any time he'd be called up. So that the assumption that got somehow insinuated into the campaign that Bill Clinton knew he had pulled a fast one and knew he had got out of the draft was simply patently wrong on the basis of my experience and knowledge and the knowledge and experience of many others who were there at the time. I think he could have handled it better in terms of remembering more of the details, being more upfront with more of the details. I think, quite honestly, he didn't remember. I didn't remember. I mean, people reminded me of certain occurrences that occurred, certain things that happened in the 1969, in that era, I had no idea of. Somebody told me that during the course of the campaign, that Bill Clinton had gone on an anti-Vietnam demonstration. And I was curious about that. And I said, are you absolutely sure? And they said, oh, yes, I have a picture of that. He was demonstrating. And he said, this particular person, I have a picture of you demonstrating as well. I said, but I have no memory. I don't think I ever did demonstrate, did I? And, oh, yes, here's the picture. And sure enough, there I was, 22 years old, with my little picket sign against the war, marching around Trafalgar Square.
You didn't remember being in that particular demonstration or at any demonstration?
I specifically had no memory of being in any demonstration in England. I mean, that may be a sign of early dementia. I mean, I am moving into middle age very quickly, but so is Bill Clinton.
My guest is Harvard political economist Robert Reich. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Reich. He's a Harvard political economist and has been an advisor to Bill Clinton. I'm curious what it feels like to you today to have a friend who will be the next president of the United States, a close friend.
I can't quite believe it, Terry. Well, you imagine what it would feel like. I mean, just conjure up in your mind a good friend of 24, 25 years and assume that that friend last night became the president-elect of the United States. It doesn't sink in. I honestly cannot believe it. Every once in a while, my wife and I turn to each other and we say, you know, Bill is going to become president.
Does it make you uncomfortable when people ask you about your relationship with him or ask you about the things that you remember him about, you know, from college? Because it's hard for me to imagine, you know, having a friend who's president. I have nothing to quite compare that to. But I think it would feel kind of awkward to you know, talk about a friend who's become such a public figure. So I wonder what that's been like for you now and also during the campaign, especially when, like, the character issue is such a big thing. Yeah. and friends of his were being questioned a lot.
Well, to some extent, it felt awkward at first. I felt that our friendship was, like most friendships, a private affair. It was a relationship that was privileged. I didn't want to share it with anybody else. But it became very clear that I had to. Partly in order to defend my friend from allegations that I knew were false, partly to fill in a picture where I knew that the picture that the other side was painting was simply wrong. And as I began talking, it became easier and easier. There's still elements of our friendship that are off bounds. I simply find them too personal, like any friendship. It's not that anything, I'm hiding anything. It's just that certain conversations about our lives and our hopes and our families don't belong on the public record. Bill Clinton stayed over at our house about a year ago when he was, just before he had decided to run. My boys know him pretty well, and they woke him up in the morning and knocked on his door, and he allowed them to come in, and they woke him up, essentially, And one of my boys said last night, you know, Dad, we're probably the only kids in America, aside from his immediate family, to know what kind of underwear the next president of the United States wears. there's an odd blend of intimacy and publicness here that I can't quite deal with.
Right, right. So you'll be able to call him at the White House, I guess?
I don't think so. I'm. You know, that would be very intrusive. Once somebody becomes president, they move into a different realm of reality.
Right.
Old friends. I'm sure if he wanted to talk to me, that would be fine. I think it would be a little bit out of bounds for an old friend to call him in the Oval Office when he's sitting there worrying about affairs of state. Well, there's another problem. Again, consider one of your old friends becoming president. Do you call that person by their first name, or do you call that person Mr. or Ms. President?
Yeah. What are you going to do?
I don't know. It's going to be very odd. I think when I'm sitting with him alone, if I ever do have that occasion, it's going to be very difficult to say Mr. President after 24 years of calling him Bill. On the other hand, when I'm sitting with other people, I suppose I have to call him Mr. President.
Robert Reich, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Terry, it was a pleasure.
Robert Reich is a Harvard political economist, a Clinton advisor, and the author of The Work of Nations. This is Fresh Air.